You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Former Senator Howard Baker said, "There are three things I simply cannot understand: the Holy Ghost, the Middle East, and the House of Representatives." Debbie Wasserman Schultz has served in the House since 2005, and she draws on her political and personal experience to urge action on some of the most serious problems the United States faces, problems that arise again and again in Congress. Her book, which was written with Julie Fenster, is called For the Next Generation, A Wake-Up Call to Solving Our Nation's Problems. It's published by St. Martin's Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Representative Wasserman Schultz to our show today. Good to see you.
You too. Thank you for having me.
Last week, Representative Luis Gutierrez was here, and we discussed the shutdown and the debt ceiling. Also, his concern that this is just taken over, and we're not talking about immigration, we're not talking about foreign policy, we're not talking about all sorts of other things.
The shutdown has really blocked out the sun on any other priority that we have facing us, and obviously we have many. We need to continue to focus on making sure that our economy has a more robust recovery. We need to make sure that we focus on immigration reform. We need to focus on improving our education system. We have healthcare reform that we need to work together to implement. And all of this
is... The environment,
energy, investing in alternative energy and renewables. All of this pales into the background.
Now, Congress, as I'm sure you know, has remained at an impasse, but most of the pundits are predicting a last-minute agreement. How close or far do you think that we are from a continuing resolution to fund government and end the shutdown?
It doesn't feel very close. We would have hoped that some more would have developed over the weekend. The Republican offer, the most recent Republican offer, had far too short a time frame for increasing the debt ceiling.
6 weeks.
Yeah, 6 weeks.
Which would have been Thanksgiving.
Exactly. Right as the holiday season begins, President Obama was right to reject that. It was just too short. We can't be back in this again in 6 weeks.
Why has Obamacare stopped being at the heart of this disagreement? It seemed to be the only thing that had to be resolved.
Because I think the Republicans realized that, number one, they aren't going to, that was a ransom that was unsuccessful. They aren't going to repeal or delay Obamacare, and they looked crazy. The closer we got to shutdown, now we're in our 14th day, and the closer we get to defaulting, all in the name of denying people quality, affordable health care. So now they are kind of all over the map.
Do you like the facts that Fox News calls it slim down?
I try to ignore the cute little names that Fox comes up for very serious issues. It goes along with most of the right's simplifying complex problems over simply.
Well, the current situation has brought Paul Ryan back into the news. He's proposing cuts to, among other things, Medicare, which, as I understand it, is an important issue for you.
Well, I represent a district in South Florida where, is heavily senior citizen oriented. This is just a retread of Paul Ryan's quest. He was the architect of the proposal to turn Medicare into a voucher system, so it's not surprising that he's proposing cuts.
Well, the governor of your state, Rick Scott, made his fortune in hospitals. Although I understand his corporation lost a major legal battle about its practices, but I would think that he would be concerned about all of those elderly people in his state.
No.
He sought to block federal employees, called navigators, from helping Floridians to enroll in health insurance exchange.
He aided and abetted the Republican legislature in denying the Medicaid expansion funds, $51 billion that Florida would have received, and leaving a million people in Florida uninsured. His Department of Health is actually prohibiting the navigators, the people who are there to help people learn about their options in the exchanges, and won't let them use Department of Health facilities to actually convey that information.
And what is what is the rationale for that?
Oh, he's just an obstructionist. He opposes Obamacare. He says essentially that he will absolutely do nothing to assist in the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. And this is a person who is, Rick Scott is not in government for the right reasons, and I think he's going to lose next year as a result.
Representative Tim Wheelskamp, the Kansas Republican, said on Face the Nation yesterday that Thursday's deadline to raise the nation's debt ceiling would not have a major impact unless the White House causes it. He said there are no payments due October 17 to pay our debtors, our creditors. There are no payments until November 18th.
We run out of borrowing authority, and the shocking naivete and ignorance of Tea Party Republicans in the House of Representatives. Another example is Ted Yoho, who actually said...
Of your state.
Of my state, yes, who said that not only does he need someone to prove to him why we need to raise the debt ceiling, but he thinks that defaulting would actually bring stability to the markets. I mean, this is the extremism that we're dealing with, and it's why we need to come together so that we can fight this extremism and inject some sanity into the process.
Well, Yoho and others are saying that there were dire predictions when sequestration went into effect, and that little negative has come out of it.
Well, little negative to that he can feel. I mean, I was on the soccer field sidelines of my daughter's soccer game on Saturday in South Florida, and a mom came up to me who works for Social Security and who has been out of work for 10 days because she's been furloughed. She told me about her family living paycheck to paycheck. And, you know, she doesn't know how they're going to do it unless the government reopens. And the sequester adds insult to injury. There are kids who can't go to their Head Start program. There are cuts to research. And, you know, those are long-term. Those are felt in the long term. I mean, and so the things that I talk about in For the Next Generation are really designed to sound the alarm bell, because we continue to go from crisis to crisis, and we're really jeopardizing our children's future. And, you know, every politician says that, and says they care about the next generation. You know, For me, I have twin 14-year-olds and a 10-year-old, so, you know, caring about the next generation is not something I say in the abstract. It's who I look at in the backseat of my car. You know, at the dinner table, it's right there.
Although conservatives say that they're concerned about the next generation or future generations because we're going to saddle them with so much debt.
Well, we shouldn't saddle them with debt, and we don't have to. And that's why President Obama and Democrats have proposed deficit reduction, already achieved deficit reduction with the Affordable Care Act, and agreed to the last austerity measure that the Republicans proposed.
Well, do you think that the Republicans have been successful in saying that so much of this debt, which really goes back to the Bush administration, is Obama's fault?
It's utterly ridiculous to suggest that it's Obama's fault. I mean, President George W. Bush inherited a record surplus from President Clinton. And then he went into two wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, unpaid for, and the Medicare prescription Part D program unpaid for, which was a good thing, but not a good thing not to pay for it. And then cut taxes twice without paying for it. So he handed over President Obama, you know, significant deficits. And, you know, so the Republicans were the architect of the deficit. But it doesn't even matter how we got here. We need to work together and set aside our differences and find common ground.
I'm talking with Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz. She's also currently chair of the Democratic National Committee and the author, with the help of Julie M. Fenster, of a new book called For the Next Generation, A Wake-Up Call to Solving Our Nation's Problems. In a chapter on political discourse and discord, you write about the 2011 impasse over raising the debt ceiling. Are things worse now?
They've spiraled pretty far downward, yes, unfortunately. I mean, in 2011, we went right to the brink. We saw the downgrading of our credit rating as a result of threatening default. So we know, as we're 2 days from that now, we're right in the same place we were in the summer of 2011 with no deal in sight. The positions have become ever more hardened. And what we need to do is we need some rational, you know, right-thinking Republicans and Democrats to come together and set that extremism aside.
Well, many people date the growing partisanship to when Newt Gingrich was the Speaker of the House. But right now he is advising Republicans uh, to uh, to soften their claim, their demands.
And he knows from experience.
But you've been in Congress since 2005. Have you seen partisanship harden over that short period?
I have. This is my 21st year in office. I was in the Florida legislature for 12 years, and about 13 of those years I've been in the minority. So I've always had to find a way to reach across the aisle.
You mean because you're Jewish, you're in the minority?
Well, that goes without saying. But no, in a partisan sense. But I've always had to reach across the aisle to be effective. And I've never seen the political process as polarized as this.
Do you get into discussions with some of your colleagues about things like evolution or climate change? Or, you know, is that a lost cause?
What has happened is that we just don't have really many opportunities to interact outside of the committee meetings or when we're in the chamber. And then we're usually, you know, drawing our own, you're going to our respective corners. I've actually, as a result, co-hosted a dinner that myself and a colleague, Congressman Dan Webster, who's a Republican colleague of mine from Florida, have hosted, you know, 4 or 5 of these dinners where each of us invites a member of the opposite party. And because we don't have any opportunity to get to know each other as human beings outside of the chamber. And, you know, you can build more trust that way when you've broken bread with someone and gotten to know them personally. And there's just not near enough of that that goes on in Washington. And as a result, you know, our decision making suffers.
People tend to stay with their own.
They do. But, you know, much more so in Congress than I saw in the legislature. I mean, we had a lot more inter-party interaction in the legislature. And even in Florida, we were a part-time legislature, so that we were there far less than we are in Congress. But the party divisions, the physical separation, and the almost complete lack of interaction really, I think, hurts our decision-making ability to come together.
In your book, you described an email you received from Alan West.
Yeah.
Now, he's also from Florida.
Yes, and is no longer in Congress. I think directly attributable to the fact that he was so extreme and so divisive. Yeah, after a debate we had on the House floor, he sent me a really offensive tirade by email, in which he actually tracked my email down because we'd never spoken and I hadn't met him. And you know, he called me the most viable, vile, despicable member of the House of Representatives, and that I wasn't a lady, and therefore I didn't afford due respect from him. And the mudslinging gets so personal now, even among members.
But he gets a lot of press, as so do some of the other people who say similar wild things on both sides.
And that's why the rhetoric needs
and,
to be toned down.
And do you think that's the reason that they do that?
Or of course.
They become darlings of the media?
They become darlings of their respective philosophical media, gets them on TV, gets them more attention. You know, what Alan West did after he sent that tirade to me and the press found out about it, He sent out a fundraising email and raised money off of his pride in what he said to me, and you know, so in that sense, I guess he was successful, but it hurts the process, and it hurts our ability to work together.
Christine Lagarde, the head of the IMF, urged the United States to raise the debt ceiling to avoid, quote, massive disruption the world over. Does international pressure have any impact when many conservatives are skeptical about international institutions?
Well, it has an impact on people in Congress who understand that we are living in a global economy. But unfortunately, too many of the Tea Partiers in Congress really think that we should, you know, start shutting the borders down, that we shouldn't pay attention to, you know, to anyone else outside this country. And they are willing to ignore, you know, economists that really know probably a little bit better than they do.
Although I received an email from a conservative group that suggested that Europeans haven't exactly handled their own fiscal crises in a constructive way. So who are they to tell us what to do?
Well, you know, Christine Lagarde is someone who has certainly made an effort at leading Europe out of the fiscal crises that they've faced. And they're actually in much better shape than they were 2 years ago. In fact, if we default now, we're actually in a far different situation than we would have been if we defaulted 2 years ago, far worse.
The press often presents the Democrats as behaving in much the same way as the Republicans, which suggests that what we really have is two crazy sides fighting it out.
See, that's just a false equivalency. I mean, it is an unfair comparison. I know 2 years ago, just for example, when I went home and voted for that debt ceiling deal, and I was in the minority of Democrats that voted yes— I had to go home and defend $1.2 trillion in cuts that I was willing to support so we wouldn't default. And
a lot of liberals were very upset.
Yes, but I talked to my constituents and spent some political capital out of necessity for the country. And because they trust me, they settled down and realized, okay, she probably did the right thing. I didn't win them all over. But you have to be willing to take that political risk because that's what they sent us to Washington to do.
My guest is Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who has written with the help of Julie M. Fenster for The Next Generation, A Wake-Up Call in Solving Our Nation's Problems. It's published by St. Martin's Press. Stay with us for more. We are back with Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who's written with Julie Fenster a book called For the Next Generation, A Wake-Up Call to Solving Our Nation's Problems. It's published by St. Martin's Press. You've said, quote, "The Republicans, because they don't like their kitchen redesign, are trying to burn the house down." Do conservatives really want to burn the house down?
Well, when you're willing to threaten our economy and default potentially for the first time in our nation's history, all in the name of whether or not we're going to make sure that everybody has access to quality, affordable health care, that analogy, I think, is appropriate. It's like they are willing to burn the house down because they don't like their kitchen redesign. What would you do? In the case of not liking your kitchen redesign, you would either live with it or rip out the cabinets or, change the countertops, but you wouldn't burn your house down. And they are willing to jeopardize our entire economy and our future all because they can't accept that the Affordable Care Act is settled law. It's irresponsible and unacceptable.
Well, they also are reading their poll numbers. Do you think that matters? Do you think they see themselves as fighting the good fight, despite the fact that there is some possibility that they're going to lose seats in the next election?
This is so beyond polls at this point for them. I mean, this is that they're allowing a hardcore of extremists in their caucus to control what happens and set the agenda for this country and allow the tail to wag the dog. I mean, John Boehner is the Speaker of the House of Representatives. We know he's said that shutting the government down was an unwise course, and yet he allowed it. And now he's allowing us to come perilously close to defaulting because he sadly seems to care more about holding on to his speakership and power than he does about making sure we do the right thing.
Well, some people are saying he's doing that because he is concerned that if he loses his speakership, the alternative would be somebody from the Tea Party taking over the speakership.
Well, look, that first
is
of
that
all,
possible? Would most of the Republicans vote for a leader who's further right than John Boehner?
He has enough support in his conference to put a bill on the floor. He has more than 21 of his members who've said they would support a clean spending resolution with no strings attached so we could reopen the government and who believe that we shouldn't default. And he simply has to put a bill on the floor that lets the whole House vote instead of relying on a majority of Republicans.
Now, why do you think that Republicans are so adamant against the Affordable Care Act? After all, it was originally proposed by the Heritage Foundation,
right,
which is now opposed to it. And it was enacted as Romney Care in Massachusetts and has been, as far as I can tell, a big success. But it was a Republican program.
Because the Republicans, sadly, now are controlled by people who, for the first time, are not willing to accept the outcome of an election, even though they were on the short end of it, who are not willing to accept President Obama as a legitimate president, and who are not willing to, after going all the way through our normal democratic process, where a bill becomes a law, is signed by the president, upheld by the Supreme Court, and then we have a presidential election on, so the voters can affirm whether or not they support it, they still aren't willing to accept it and move on. I mean, even Al Gore, who arguably won the presidency in 2000, knew that we had to move on past the Supreme Court decision that he vehemently disagreed with because he couldn't jeopardize our democracy.
Richard Nixon had done that earlier.
Exactly. And what these Tea Partiers are willing to do is they're willing to shake our democracy to its core. And that's why it is so absolutely imperative that we all screw up some courage and that we see that the Republicans who aren't Tea Partiers or who know this is wrong to reach across the aisle and work with us so that we can make sure we can get us out of this really harmful situation.
Well, many people are saying that the Tea Partiers who seem to be most adamant are the ones who are safest because of gerrymandering.
Yes, and that's absolutely true. I mean, that is a huge problem, is that many of them are going home and their constituents are applauding them. But if you look at this isn't about poll numbers or about politics. This is really about just getting things done for the country. But there is a reason that a number of them in the competitive races, the number of competitive races for them has expanded since this happened, because the Republicans are at their lowest approval rating in since it's been measured. And they are getting the lion's share of the blame, which they deserve.
Associated Press published a poll last week indicating that public approval of Congress is down to 5%.
Yes.
And a new Huffington Post YouGov poll finds that only 25% of Americans think that their own member of Congress should be reelected. Yet they're going to reelect them, I'm assuming.
Well, we have the widest margin in the generic ballot on the question of whether or not the American people want to see Democrats control Congress or Republicans. And there is a wide margin that says that Democrats should control Congress. But the reason I want people to read my book, Leonard, though, is because we really have to stop this division. We have an opportunity here, because we've been in the midst of a crisis, to realize the error of our ways and to simply stop taking our hardened positions.
People often will point out that a crisis is an opportunity to come up with new solutions.
Yeah, I agree with that. And hopefully, after we're past this crisis, which I hope will be a matter of hours, that we can take on the issues that I talk about and for the next generation, education and healthcare and the economy, energy, children's safety, and so many others, so that we can really move forward, because the way we should be measuring our nation's success is how well our children are doing. And right now, we're not doing so well on that measure.
My guest is Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Her book, For the Next Generation, A Wake-Up Call on Solving Our Nation's Problems, is published by St. Martin's Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You're a member of the Appropriations Committee,
yes,
one of the most powerful committees. Does that committee have any role in these negotiations?
Yes. The continuing resolution is an appropriations bill. So when we go through the negotiation process of what should be included in the continuing spending resolution, the Appropriations Committee leads that effort.
So what happens in committee? Is the partisanship as evident there?
The Appropriations Committee in its heyday, even when I was first appointed to it in 2006, was an example of bipartisanship. Even with all the partisanship swirling around, even back in the 1990s when Newt Gingrich was Speaker, the appropriators prided themselves on working together and rising above it. We've spiraled downward, and unfortunately, we're not even able to get most of the appropriations bills onto the floor, never mind out of committee.
Well, since the 1970s, power has been taken away from the committees and become concentrated in party leadership. I'm assuming that's aggravated political divisions.
I mean, just the other day, we pointed out on the House floor that the Republicans changed a rule on October 1st when the government shut down that took the rights of members, all members, away. Previously, we were able to actually put an amendment on the floor to a Senate bill that had come over related to the budget. And the Republicans changed the rules on October 1st so that only the majority leader, their majority leader, could decide when an amendment was going to be able to be added to a Senate bill. I mean, it's just an unprecedented power grab.
That the first time in the history of the U.S. Congress?
I can't say the whole history of the U.S. Congress, but that has been a rule for many, many years, and it gives all members the opportunity to offer an amendment to a Senate bill, which is now only available to the majority leader.
Do you think they're shooting themselves in their own feet because somewhere down the line the Democrats are going to be in the majority, and if they say, well, this is a rule that you implemented, now you can't add an amendment, tough luck?
It certainly doesn't bode well for us working together, and I think they're shooting the conduct they're engaging in is shooting the country, and it's harming our future. This is not just about who wins and loses today. It's about the impact that these really harmful decisions is going to have on our future.
But isn't it to some degree about who wins and loses? Because a number of people in Congress have said, well, we have to get something out of this.
But Well, that's certainly and what the,
it was
that's
a matter of dignity.
That's what Congressman Stuttman said, who is a Tea Party Republican, who said that this is a matter of the government shutdown and how we end up with this is a matter of respect. That we have to stop being disrespected, and we have to get something out of this. But then he said, I don't know what it is, but we have to get something. This is crazy. This is not a power struggle. This is about whether or not we are going to make sure that we have a stable economy and a more robust recovery and create jobs and fight for the middle class, which Democrats are passionately interested in doing, and the Republicans seem to only care about embracing the Tea Party.
If the impasse of the debt is resolved, is there another issue that looms for another round of gridlock?
Well, it's going to continue to loom depending on how long we extend the debt ceiling and how long we give for this continuing spending resolution and reopening the government.
Well, there are just 6 weeks left in the year during which the House is scheduled to be in session.
Right.
Are there any other major legislative issues that are coming up before the end of the year?
Yeah, I mean, immigration reform is something that is really a pivotal to our economy. We know that we'll have huge economic benefit from passing immigration reform besides it being the moral thing to do. And, you know, we're not able to spend any time on that. And we need time because there's a lot of stuff to iron out related to that.
And then there's the farm bill that is still up in the air. We just recently saw another
$40 billion in cuts to food stamps that the Republicans passed out of the House of Representatives.
Will that also affect what happened in South Dakota where farmers have lost so many cattle because of this late season blizzard or early season blizzard?
Without a farm bill and the ability to provide that relief, there's, you know, in regular order, in the normal process, there's no question. And, you know, the odds of getting legislation to give them emergency relief in this environment are slim to none.
So other than naming post offices, what has gotten through Congress this year?
You know, there's a reason, unfortunately, that the Republican-led Congress in the House is considered the do-nothingest of do-nothing Congresses. We are meeting the least number of days in session. We aren't working together. The Republicans have allowed the Tea Party to control the direction we're going. And because they are more interested in dismantling government, they think it's a plus that we're not doing very much.
Are they interested in dismantling government or dismantling the portions of government that they don't like? Because there were many Tea Party people who carried signs last year saying, don't mess with my Medicare, don't mess with my Social Security. Did they not know that this comes from the government?
They're also willing to have a whole lot of government as long as it focuses on what a woman can do with her own reproductive health and her body. So, yes, it certainly does depend on, you know, what kind of government you're talking about. But generally, they have been very interested in shrinking the role of government dramatically.
And you discuss many problems in your book. Some of them are very specifically related to the role of government: energy, education, gun control, civil rights. Over the long term, do you have any that you would put ahead of the others?
Right now, the economy has to continue to be front and center. I mean, we are facing, you know, existential threats to the stability of our economy, and we've got to make sure the president is really focused on trying to continue to focus on job creation, get this economy to, you know, kick into higher gear. The Republicans have been an obstacle to that.
Well, Ronald Reagan said government is the enemy, and he is constantly quoted. But did he run the White House that way?
No.
Wasn't he also an advocate for the imperial presidency?
I think it was Bob Dole, actually, that said that he and Ronald Reagan would not be able to be candidates, or, you know, nominees in today's Republican Party because they were too willing to reach across the aisle and work with the other side. And Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan are legendary for the deals they were able to cut to work together. And we need more rationality and common sense. And we need, what I talk about in the book is we need more mothers. You know, we need a mom's sensibility to be applied to how we get things done. A lot of the women in Congress on both sides of the aisle talk about how if we just put the women in a room for a few hours, we would solve a lot of these problems.
Because, so you think Michelle Bachmann will solve the problem?
I think we would have to be a little more selective than that, probably.
You devote just one chapter to foreign policy. From a long-term standpoint, what are the biggest foreign policy issues that the United States faces?
Well, we're very immersed in making the Israel-Palestinian peace process a priority. I'm proud of Secretary Kerry and President Obama for bringing both sides back to the table for direct bilateral negotiations. The Middle East continues to be a tinderbox that, if we can get some stability there, will obviously be in the long-term interest of the United States.
A number of Republicans have criticized the president for allowing Vladimir Putin to set foreign policy in Syria.
Well, I would say it's a gross exaggeration to say that Vladimir Putin is setting foreign policy that directs the United States actions. I mean, we have specifically and rightfully said anytime we can use diplomacy as a tool to reduce tension and the jeopardy that people's lives are in, you need to put that first. But all options have to remain on the table.
Do you support everything that the president does? The Committee to Protect Journalists has issued a report saying that President Obama's attacks on the press, I'm quoting, are the most aggressive since the Nixon administration.
I mean, I don't agree with everything the president has done. He and I have different views on Cuba and our approach to how we can push for freedom for the Cuban people. And, there are some issues that I talk about in the book related to how we approach the application of privacy laws in this country. And it's but I know it's something that President Obama is continuing to try to focus on striking a balance on.
On the other hand, do you think the press has played a role in making this gridlock situation worse?
I think that the constant quest on the part of the press to focus on the tension and the division is really harmful. I mean, I think, and I mentioned in the book, that the press bears some responsibility in that, because they're constantly fanning the flames, which isn't at all helpful.
Well, we love narrative, and so that leads to who's winning and who's losing.
And the 24-hour news cycle it puts a lot of pressure on reporters, and I understand that. But, the fact, sometimes I just scratch my head at what some of these reporters find important to focus on as a story, when it's not at all helpful in terms of informing the public and harmful in terms of fanning the flames and making things worse and sowing seeds of division.
Debbie Wasserman Schultz has written a book with writer Julie M. Fenster called For the Next Generation, A Wake-Up Call to Solving Our Nation's Problems. It's published by St. Martin's Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Leonard. Wonderful to be with you.